The White Nationalist Pipeline, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. When President Trump tweeted about South Africa earlier this week, he was basically repeating the talking points of white nationalists there.
The undertones were that there is a burgeoning race war in South Africa.
Turns out Trump heard it first on Fox News.
If you want a white nationalist conspiracy theory to be made a little bit more palatable for the public, then you go to Tucker Carlson. He's your guy.
Plus, how electric cars are increasing the demand for cobalt and child labor.
The problem with all of these targets is that government officials know absolutely nothing about mining. So what sounds great in Silicon Valley is in reality much more complicated.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for being here this Friday. We start the show today with a tweet from President Trump, not the ones lamenting the witch hunt or fake news. Nope, we want to start with President Trump's tweet from earlier this week about South Africa, his first tweet ever as president, to include the word Africa, in fact. And it was about the South African government seizing land from white farmers and about the, quote, large-scale killing of farmers, end quote. Trump tagged Fox News anchor Tucker Carlson in his tweet because, you guessed it, the president appears to have heard about this first from Carlson's show on Fox.
We've got an exclusive investigation for you tonight. The president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, has begun, and you may have seen this in the press, seizing land from his own citizens without compensation because they are the wrong skin color. That is literally the definition of racism.
Now, this isn't the first time Trump appears to tweet about something right after hearing it on Fox. But what's different this time is that the president's tweet basically repeated talking points used by white nationalists in South Africa, particularly those of a group called Afriforum. We wanted to find out more about what's really going on with land reform in South Africa and about Afriforum. So we turned to Lindsay Schutel. She's a reporter for Quartz Africa based in Johannesburg.
Afriforum sees itself as a civil rights organization that specifically works towards what they say is protecting Afrikaner culture and identity. Afrikaans is the second most widely spoken language in South Africa. And what's interesting is that Afriforum is something that is particularly aimed at white South Africans and not for the black and mixed race South Africans who all speak Afrikaans. And Afriforum has positioned itself on a number of issues with crime, for example, arguing that white people were under threat after the end of apartheid.
So a civil rights organization in defense of the white minority in South Africa, is it fair to say this is a white minority that was disappointed to see the end of apartheid?
They wouldn't come out and say that they were disappointed, but they have certainly argued that they are disappointed that certain things have changed. They have positioned themselves as the voice of the minority that is under threat. And that threat isn't necessarily real. And I don't think it's a threat that is any different to what any other South African feels. And that's where the controversy around Afriforum comes about.
So fact check for us some of Afriforum's common talking points. I'm thinking of their notion that attacks on white-owned farms in South Africa are increasing or that there is a genocide against white farmers. What's the reality?
Because they're trying to position themselves as an organization that must be taken seriously, they don't necessarily use the word genocide. But Afriforum has been very effective in placing a disproportionate amount of attention on the idea that white farmers are being killed in South Africa. And I don't want to take away from the fact that there is crime in South Africa. And yes, white farmers have been killed on their farms. But the reality of crime in South Africa is that it is violent crime. White farmers are not the only ones who are suffering. People who are affected mostly by crime are, in fact, black women, because they are the most economically vulnerable and the most socially vulnerable. Data that was collected by AgriSA, which is an agricultural union, found that while attacks peaked to about 1,000 a year in 2002, they've actually been on a steady decline. And the murders themselves have never gone above 200 from 1998 up until 2018. They have steadily declined. Those crime statistics should be looked at on a national level instead of looking at white farmers in particular.
Right. What kind of influence does Afriforum have in South African politics?
In South African politics, Afriforum's influence is negligible. Yes, they're good at having a press conference. They will organize a protest here and there, but they don't really have any say in parliament. They have no say over policy. The frustrating thing about Afriforum is that their PR is very good outside of the country.
Ernst Roetz, the deputy CEO of Afriforum, says that the South African government has made it clear they have no interest in considering the views of minority communities, and they obviously consider themselves a minority community. And in fact, President Cyril Ramaphosa sees the forced dispossession of black land during colonialism as the original sin that must be resolved in South Africa. So there remains a serious dilemma over land in South Africa. Am I wrong about that?
There is a deep dilemma about land in South Africa, and it's for two reasons. One, land is particularly emotional. It's emotional because the majority of the country, black South Africans, were forcefully removed from that land from as early as 1914, and that's by legislation. So we're not even counting colonial disposition. We're counting just the apartheid legislation. So, of course, there's a lot of emotion attached to that. But then there's the economic issue in that black South Africans are the majority, 79% of the population, but they own just over 1% of agricultural land and less than 10% of urban property. And that's a worrying sign of the inequality and the fact that the deep inequality of apartheid still hasn't been addressed. But then I'll get to the issue of Ernst Roetz arguing that President Cyril Ramaphosa has not spoken to the minority of the country. Right now in South Africa, there are hearings happening in every single province. People are literally lining up for their turn at the mic, where they are giving their testimony and their views on the land policy and how to fix that. And not only that, those hearings were broadcast on national television. And then just yesterday, because of the intense media coverage about South Africa's land policy and the misinformation that is going around, President Cyril Ramaphosa actually met with white farmers and assured them that this is not a case of land grabs, that yes, redress needs to happen, but it won't happen with the sense of violence that people are fearing, with the sense of injustice. I think it is unfair of Roots to argue that the minority is being ignored when we are literally having a public process where everybody gets to have their say.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. So let's move on, Lindsay, to President Trump's tweet about murdered white South African farmers, because there's a chronology leading up to that tweet. Let's go back to May when members of Afriforum traveled to the U.S. to lobby for their interests. Who did they meet with?
So when Ernst Roetz, the head of AfriForum, came to the States in May, he actually met with John Bolton. It's disconcerting to think that he met with then security advisor, because that means that the United States is taking AfriForum's claims seriously. The other thing that was, of course, very effective and very classically AfriForum is that they were on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News. Not only were they promoting AfriForum's new book on the so-called targeting of South Africa's Afrikaans minority, the undertones were that there is a burgeoning race war in South Africa, that the country is about to succumb to violence. AfriForum's claims in South Africa are largely dismissed. We know that there is no beginning of a race war here. But I think it's scary when AfriForum's claims are taken seriously on such an international platform, because it just completely undoes the work of reconciliation that so many South Africans have put into so far.
Well, as you say, they're clever self-publicists. I mean, Tucker Carlson comments on this at 8 p.m. on his Fox News show, talks about radio silence on South Africa, the State Department. Then at 10:30 p.m., Trump tweets his concern and says he's ordered Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to look into the South Africa situation. All the while, all the other cable channels are talking about Manafort and Cohen. I mean, they also got some luck too, didn't they?
Exactly. Because even back in May, Carlson had AfriForum on. So it's not that the situation hasn't been on US TV. It's just, I think, quite frankly, convenient for the Trump administration, given his own domestic situation, to divert attention to South Africa, where frankly nothing is happening.
Lindsay Schutel, a reporter with Quartz Africa, speaking with us from Cape Town. Thanks very much, Lindsay.
Thanks very much.
I want to bring Will Carlos in here. He covers hate and extremism for Reveal. He says AfriForum did their research when they chose to meet with Fox News' Tucker Carlson.
If you want a white nationalist conspiracy theory to be made a little bit more palatable for the public, then you go to Tucker Carlson. He's famous for hosting people who are sort of quasi-white nationalists. I think Heidi Berich from the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, called him the hate mainstreamer in chief or something like that. And, you know, I don't think he's really engaged in pure journalism at this point. I think he's much more interested in sort of pushing certain ideas, and increasingly those ideas are coming from the far right of the political spectrum.
So connecting back to South Africa, I think we should recall for a moment Dylan Roof, the white supremacist who shot and killed 9 people in a Charleston, South Carolina church in 2015. There's a photograph of him wearing a jacket with 2 flags on it. One is the flag that South Africa flew during decades of apartheid, and the other is the flag of Rhodesia, the former British colony that is now Zimbabwe. Why does South Africa's white genocide myth and others like it have such an appeal for white supremacists in the U.S.?
Basically, the far right, the racist right in America, has gone through this transformation over the past couple of decades, really, where it's gone from being just overtly racist, just sort of saying, you know, white people are better than people who are not white, to going into this sort of new way of selling their ideas, which is to talk about white genocide, to talk about this idea of European heritage being kind of wiped off the map. And so what they do is they use South Africa as the sort of canary in the coal mine for this stuff. They point to South Africa and they say, look what's happening there. You've got a black majority who are sort of wiping out the Christian, the white heritage that South Africa was sort of, you know, formed into. And it's nonsense. It's not happening. There isn't a white genocide going on in South Africa, but it's a selling point.
So the subtext for these American white supremacists is that we can't let ourselves go the way of South Africa?
Exactly. Exactly. That's what they believe. You know, they believe that unless immigration is really stopped, and a lot of them argue for sort of a white ethno state in the United States, basically just making it a white country, they argue that if that doesn't happen, then, you know, white heritage, white culture is going to kind of disappear in the United States. And yeah, they point to South Africa as an example of that. And South Africa is just not an example of that.
So we've got Afroforum coming to the U.S. to appeal to certain groups here. You've got former White House advisor Steve Bannon going to Europe, talking to far-right nationalist groups there. Right after Trump's tweet on South African white farmers, David Duke tweeted that Russia has already agreed to take in 15,000 white South Africans. Why are groups like this trying to find support with each other outside their countries? I mean, what is the plan? Do they have a plan?
I think the answer to that is that, you know, these are fringe groups, right? And fringe groups find each other. You know, it doesn't matter what you're into. With the internet today, you will find the people, the sliver of the population who are into the same things as you, whether they're in, you know, Siberia or Cape Town. I don't think these guys are working very much with each other, although there are signs. I mean, for example, there was a big white nationalist rally earlier this year where there were people, you know, invited from all over the world, from Europe and also from Japan, to come and talk there. So there are signs there. But I think it's more just a shared interest. And, you know, ultimately, although these people believe similar things, those things mean different things in different places. So the fight for white people in South Africa is actually a different beast to the fight for white people in the United States.
Will Carlos covers hate and extremism for Reveal. Thanks very much, Will. Always good to talk.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Marco.
Blacks, whites, farms, and Africa. That mix doesn't always have to make for a tense story. This is country western folk from Ivory Coast, two Ivorian musicians who fell in love with these sounds in West Africa, Jessa B and Peter One. Jessa B and Peter One recorded what would become a regional hit in West Africa in 1985, a one-hit wonder on vinyl that never found its way out of West Africa, not through official distribution anyway, until now. The album is called Our Garden Needs Its Flowers, and it's just been re-released in the U.S., where Jessa B and Peter One now both live. Jess in San Francisco, Peter conveniently in Nashville, the home of country western. Now their 1985 album could get a second life.
Yeah, a second life, I would say a new life. But in the United States and hopefully around the rest of the world.
We'll hear more from Peter One next week on the show about how two young men from Ivory Coast ended up making an album with pedal steel guitar and harmonica. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. One of Japan's top medical schools recently issued an apology. Tokyo Medical University admitted to lowering the test scores of female applicants to prevent them from getting in. Japan has long struggled with gender equality in the workplace, but now the problem is becoming more urgent. As Sally Herships reports, treatment of women in the workplace is having far-reaching consequences for Japan.
Kumi Matsumoto has a problem. She has a full-time job, but she's Japanese, and working full-time in Japan can mean something different than in other places, like the United States.
I think in Japan, working full-time means working 24 hours. I mean, full-time, 100% warrior.
Did you say career or warrior?
Warrior. We call it business warriors.
Matsumoto works at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Tokyo. That's where she is this morning, seated at a small table in the cafeteria. It's just before 10, and workers are swiping their ID cards to enter the glass building. Matsumoto loves her job, but she already has another full-time gig, two small kids.
How can you be a business warrior and a parent?
That is a very, very challenging problem.
In Japan, long working hours are a serious issue for women and men. This is a place where karoshi, or death by overwork, is regularly reported in the news. But women still do most of the childcare. I first met Matsumoto 3 years ago when I was reporting a story for Marketplace. She was on maternity leave with her second baby, and she talked about how exhausting it was to be a working mom.
It's very normal for us to stay until midnight, and sometimes we have to stay until early in the morning next day.
Matsumoto, who's 43, says she can juggle her kids and work because her husband and her in-laws help. But that kind of support is rare here. And even with the help, Matsumoto says it can be hard to manage, especially with two kids. Here's an example. When members of Japan's legislature have to appear to answer questions, which happens a lot, they're often given those questions ahead of time. And part of Matsumoto's job is writing the answers. But most of the time, she and her coworkers, they don't know which team will get the assignment. So they all have to wait.
Which is a stupid thing. It's the most stupid thing happening in Japan, I think. But that's happening for like decades.
But things are starting to change, slowly. Japan's Prime Minister Abe has pushed for policies to advance women. The government publishes an annual report on progress. And if you turn to page 29 of this year's edition, you'll see address long working hours. All companies and government agencies with more than 300 employees are now required to come up with an action plan to increase women's participation at work and to cut down on those long hours. Matsumoto says her office finally has a new policy. If it seems unlikely you'll have to work late, you can just go home, as long as you keep checking your smartphone.
But nobody was really so excited about that. We were like, but we are staying late anyway. Right? And I was like, no, it's a miracle. It's amazing. It's awesome. And nobody even cares. I'm staying late anyway, so I don't really need to have the smartphone alert. So I was like, oh my God.
We have to, you know, change two things. One, the working style. People have to take holidays, have to enjoy their family life.
Mitsuko Horiuchi is with the Kita Kyusho Forum on Asian Women. She says Japan's problems are all tangled up. First, there's the issue of women in the workplace. Horiuchi says until things get easier for them, many will decide not to have babies. And without more babies, Japan's workforce will continue to shrink. And that means more problems, because while the workforce is shrinking, one part of the country is growing, the elderly.
And then the question is not just only childcare, but also aging care.
Aging care. Japan is running out of people to care for its aging population. Horiuchi says that means the problems that working mothers face are increasingly affecting everyone. She says, yes, the government is making an effort to address the imbalances, like a new law passed in May calling for political parties to have equal numbers of male and female candidates. But that law doesn't have any teeth.
You know, the law is only encouraged, not the obligation for the political party.
Only about 10% of Japan's parliament is made up of women. That means it ranks lower than 150 other countries, including Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. But Horiuchi says it's not just the government. Companies also need to take responsibility to hire and promote more women. Still, Horiuchi, who is 74, says the status of women is changing.
This used to be, you know, that the women, if my age, if we don't marry, and then everybody asking you, why? Women should marry. And your parents very much worried about you. Why you are single? Because women, you know, that maybe happiness should be marriage or something like. But nowadays, no one really push you to marry.
Last night, Kumi Matsumoto, the working mom, stayed at the office until 8 p.m.
What time do you think you'll go home tonight?
I actually emailed all the colleagues in my division that I have to go home at 5:30. I mean, I have to leave office at 5:30 sharp. And I really have to leave office 5:30 to pick up my children. My husband cannot do it today, so I'm just telling everybody that I really have to go.
Matsumoto says it can be hard to leave early when everyone else is staying late. To do that, you have to be brave.
But I'm a very vocal type of person, and that I'm the kind who can just tell everybody, I have to go home at 5:30. But a lot of working mothers are not that vocal.
Instead, she says they're shyer and they're having a hard time adjusting. A few years ago, Matsumoto founded a support group for mothers and fathers at her office. And at first, that's who came to meetings, moms and dads. But now, even workers without kids are coming. They want to figure out how to find the time to have kids. For The World, Sally Herships, Tokyo.
Sally reported the story with support from the Foreign Press Center, Japan. Before the break, we want to tell you about a story coming up on the show on Monday. It's about life for women facing very different challenges than what we just heard about. In Ukraine, there are memorials scattered around the country to mark the day of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. For many Ukrainians, their lives changed forever on April 26, 1986. The explosion in Reactor 4 at the plant killed thousands of people and left much of the surrounding area uninhabitable. The government designated areas where it was unsafe for people to live, but even outside of that exclusion zone, scientists are still discovering radiation hotspots. The World's Alison Herrera met some of the women living near the reactor, despite the risks.
If you measure my field.
На карту.
If you
want me to measure your field?
She took a Geiger counter into this woman's potato field to check her plants. On the edge of the exclusion zone, that's coming up Monday here on the show. I'm Marco Werman. A heat wave made flamingos in the UK lay eggs for the first time in 15 years. That's the good news. The bad news? It came too late.
They're just pensioners now. They are just not young enough to actually be able to produce fertile offspring. But they tried, which is the nice thing.
The unexpected effects of climate change. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH here in Boston. The Gold Rush was a key formative event in America's history. Enterprising men and women heading into them thar hills to pan and dig for gold in the hope of striking it rich. The little guys competing with corporations. You might say something similar is happening now in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Only it's not gold people are looking for, but cobalt. And in at least one corner of the DR Congo, it seems almost everyone, men, women, children, are out digging. Cobalt is a chemical element found in the Earth's crust, and it's become absolutely critical for our functioning in the digital age. It stabilizes the batteries in all our smartphones and our electric cars. And as demand for cobalt surges, so does its price. Journalist Vivian Walt traveled to the Democratic Republic of Congo to see the process firsthand. Walt has an in-depth story appearing in the new edition of Fortune magazine. She's now back in Paris. There's been knowledge, Vivian, about the horrible conditions for workers, including child laborers at these artisanal mines in Congo. But there's an ever-increasing demand for cobalt around the world. What specifically did you want to find out in DR Congo when you went there?
Well, there's certain questions that we went to Congo with. Yes, we knew that child labor was probably rampant, as indeed we found it was. What we wanted to know was, what are companies trying to do about this? They keep claiming that they're not in the business of buying cobalt from any mine that uses children in it. And we wanted to find out if this was really credible. The other big question for us was, what happens from now? Because there's a race on to supply the world with enough cobalt to roll out the electric car future. Until now, cobalt has mostly been used for our tech devices, but that really is a minuscule amount compared to what we're going to need if the governments around the world begin shifting to electric cars on the scale that they have said that they plan to do. So these were the two big questions that we arrived with. And it was complicated and somewhat difficult story to unpick. Whatever we found really against the wishes of the government and the police on the ground who try to stop us at every turn. Mm-hmm. And
What did they not want you to see, and what did you see?
Well, you know, when we came, the governor of the province that is sitting on, at this point, most of the world's reserves of cobalt said to us, you know, numerous times, we've got nothing to hide, we're totally open. But every, you know, minute of our reporting on the ground told us a very different story. They did not want us, certainly, to see any child miners. And yet, all you had to do was, you know, go down any little country road into any informal mine, and there were children everywhere digging for any bits of cobalt that they can possibly find.
So introduce us to one of these young miners that you met.
We ran into an 11-year-old. He's exactly the same age as my kid, who was, you know, having a wonderful summer back home. And here was this 11-year-old boy walking up the hill with a sack of cobalt on his back. He had never been to school. He probably had about 15 pounds of cobalt that he was carrying. And for that, he might possibly earn about $2 or $3 for a long day's work.
Wow.
For kids like this, that is totally worth doing. It's $2 or $3 a day that their families would not otherwise have.
And remind us what cobalt is, Vivian, why it is so vital to our digital age.
Well, it's a mineral that has what engineers call energy density. It has the energy density that other minerals don't have, which means that it's stable enough and it can last long enough to power tech devices. And more specifically, and this is the big question for the future, an electric vehicle. The amount of cobalt that an electric vehicle needs to run is about 1,000 times or more the cobalt that is found, for example, in an iPhone. So, you know, as we get millions of electric vehicles rolling off factory assembly lines, there's a big question as to how all these cars are going to be powered. And many people I interviewed said to me, you know, the problem with all of these targets that the governments have set is that government officials know absolutely nothing about mining. They know nothing about how anything is actually made. They've never been inside a mine. And so what sounds great in, you know, Silicon Valley is in reality much more complicated.
Yeah, meantime, this small slice of the Democratic Republic of Congo has just got the richest deposits in the world of cobalt. I mean, the way you describe it, is it like, you know, these kids like leave their village and kind of just go out somewhere and start digging and they find cobalt?
Well, the big mine that we were in called Kasulu actually began kind of by accident. In 2012, there were locals living on the land, and they began, according to the local government officials who we met there, the mine actually began by people digging holes in the ground to build latrines. And lo and behold, they struck cobalt with very high concentrations of the mineral and realized that they were sitting on, you know, precious resources. And thousands of people poured into the land to dig for cobalt.
Journalist Vivian Walt, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You can find Vivian's in-depth story about the Congolese cobalt business in the new edition of Fortune magazine. Twitter bots and Russian trolls appear to have a new target, vaccine safety. That's what we learned from a new study published in the American Journal of Public Health. That study found that the same kind of Russian online mischief that tried to influence the 2016 election is now being used to sow division and confusion in Western countries about the safety of vaccines. The researchers examined 1.7 million tweets published between 2014 and 2017. David Broniatowski teaches in the School of Engineering and Applied Science at George Washington University. He led the research for this study. Tell us, first of all, David, what kind of messages you were seeing online about vaccines?
We saw a wide range of different types of messages. On one hand, we saw, perhaps most surprisingly, messages from identified Russian trolls, and those messages seemed to be both pro-vaccine and anti-vaccine in equal amounts. We saw messages from a type of Twitter bot known as a content polluter that seemed to be associated with attempts to spread spam or unsolicited commercial content and malware or computer viruses. Then obviously we saw a lot of very sincere messages from normal human beings as well.
What tipped you off that Russian trolls and bots were behind a lot of these?
Well, this whole study started because we were trying to explore whether social media could be used as a more effective means of communication to see if we could more accurately communicate the risks and benefits of vaccines. And one of the first things that we observed was that although survey data show a very strong consensus regarding safety and efficacy of vaccines in the United States, there were quite a few more tweets that expressed anti-vaccine sentiment. Mm. And so we wanted to really understand why that may be the case. And that led us to start looking at whether anti-vaccine content might have been somehow amplified through bots. And once we started looking at bots, we decided to start looking as well at similar troll accounts, simply because trolls tend to use bot accounts and vice versa.
Right.
And one of the things that jumped right out of the data was that the Russian troll accounts tweeted about vaccines about 22 times more often than the average Twitter user.
Your study showed that the trolls were connected to the Internet Research Agency. Remind us what that is.
So the Internet Research Agency is a Russian organization, a Russian company that has been associated with prior propaganda efforts, perhaps best known in the context of the 2016 U.S. election. And the tweets that we analyzed were actually identified by NBC News back in January. NBC had linked those tweets to the Internet Research Agency. So therefore, we were able to determine that the Russian trolls identified in that data set were indeed promoting messages about vaccines.
Give us some examples of the messages, both pro and con vaccine, that you saw.
One of the anti-vaccine messages says something along the lines of, only the elite get clean vaccines, what do us normal people get? Which kind of sounds weird in the context of the American discourse. Mm. In addition to that, you'll see a lot of retweeting of anti-vaccine messages from other non-troll sources that are simply being amplified by the trolls. On the other hand, you may see somebody saying something along the lines of, if you say that vaccines cause autism, you can't be my friend, I will stop following you, or something like that. That might be an example of a pro-vaccine tweet. Nevertheless, it is an angry pro-vaccine tweet that seems to be promoting discord and seeking a response.
Were you able to determine whether this intentional online confusion about vaccines was at all effective?
That's a great question. We did not look at the outcome of this sort of behavior because we didn't measure the behaviors of people vaccinating per se. That's outside the scope of our study. Mm. What we were simply doing was analyzing people's Twitter behavior. However, it is a well-known research finding that people who are exposed to these sorts of messages are more likely to be hesitant, are more likely to delay. And so there's every reason to believe that this may have been the case when it comes to these particular Twitter messages.
David, you and your team discovered these bots and trolls on Twitter. What's Twitter doing about this?
I have not been in contact with Twitter, so I don't know if they are taking any specific measures regarding these particular bots and trolls. However, Twitter has deleted several of the Russian troll accounts, including those in the data sets that we drew on for the study. As I mentioned, our study was based on historical data that was stored inside an archive that we had been collecting since 2014. And Twitter is certainly very actively involved in trying to remove accounts that have been identified as bots and trolls.
David Broniatowski teaches in the School of Engineering and Applied Science at George Washington University. He led the research for a study that appeared this week in the American Journal of Public Health on bots and trolls from Russia, stoking the pro and anti-vaccine debate. David, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
It's been hot in the UK this summer, you may have heard, like really hot. And this August heat wave seems to have led to some unusual behavior from a flamboyance of flamingos. That is a real term, by the way, a flamboyance of flamingos. Anyway, these flamingos in the UK, they laid eggs for the first time in 15 years. We're going to hear more about this from Paul Rose. He's an ornithologist and researcher at Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust in southwest England. Just in terms of semantics, do you go with flock or flamboyance of flamingos, Paul?
Well, it's a flock normally when they're not doing very much, but a flamboyance for when they're doing their courtship display. A flamboyance is only when the flamingos are doing their dancing.
Yeah, so we are talking of flamboyance here. So tell us how exactly this heat wave in the UK led to this sudden laying of flamingo eggs.
So I think a combination of heat plus lots of clear skies, maximum sun exposure, has just suddenly decided in the birds that this is the optimum time for breeding, and off they went. And we have seen them build nests before, but this is the first time since 2003 that we've actually had any eggs laid.
I mean, the UK has had heat waves before. What do you think it is about the most recent heat that got them to lay eggs?
I think it's the number of high temperature days in sequence, and the fact that we had so many cloudless skies where there was just a lot of sunshine. And because the temperature just kept rising and rising and rising, as the birds kicked off nest building, they then got more and more into it because more and more members of their flock would start nest building. So then they just kind of carried on building more nests.
I mean, it is pretty amazing. The heat wave sparked these flamingos to lay eggs, but they weren't able to hatch, right?
That's right, yes. These are very old birds. Like a chicken, a female flamingo will still lay an egg, regardless of whether or not she's been mated. So even though they were ready to build the nests and the females laid the eggs, they're just pensioners now. They are just not old enough. They're not young enough to actually be able to produce fertile offspring. But they tried, which is the nice thing.
I understand the conservationist trying to train the flamingos to parent just in case this happens again. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Those flamingos were given eggs of another species, a very similar species in size and behavior, the Chilean flamingo. So the reason we gave them the Chilean flamingo eggs is just to allow them to see through a breeding cycle. And the Chilean flamingo is a near-threatened species, and it's also potentially one of the species that climate change would impact upon in the future because of the wetlands it lives in. So by allowing these Andean flamingos to rear the Chilean flamingo chicks, we are indirectly helping to grow that population in captivity.
And this is not the only way a change in climate is affecting animal behavior. Help us fit all of these flamingos into the bigger picture.
Well, there are lots of birds whose food sources are going to change or potentially disappear in terms of where they will find food for their youngsters. And we know, particularly in the UK, what we have seen as we change the environment with farming, lots of birds that used to be very common that feed their youngsters on insects. So the adult bird would eat seeds, but they have to feed their young on insects. We've seen populations plummet because we have removed the habitat for them to find the insects to feed their chicks. So if you scale that up to what climate change could do and change the balance in an ecosystem where maybe there isn't a particular food available at a particular time of year for when birds are breeding, that's going to lead to the extinction of species.
Ornithologist Paul Rose with the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust in Slimbridge in England. Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pope Francis travels to Ireland tomorrow, and while there, he's scheduled to meet with survivors of clergy sex abuse. This comes after a scathing report was published in Pennsylvania earlier this month, detailing how as many as 1,000 children were sexually abused by hundreds of Catholic clerics there. The Pope wrote an open letter in response, acknowledging the church's failure to protect kids. Maeve Lewis in Ireland was disappointed by that letter. She's the executive director of One in Four, a group that helps survivors of childhood sex abuse in Dublin.
Certainly in Ireland, the survivors have had so many apologies from so many senior church people that really they have ceased to have much impact. what Irish people, I think most Irish people, just cannot forgive is the cover-up, which was a complete betrayal of trust for ordinary Catholic people. The Irish government have for years now been trying to persuade the Vatican to release the vast archive they have of complaints that would have been passed by the Irish bishops to the Vatican, so that a clear view of all the allegations would become visible, and also that possibly some criminal prosecutions could be made. But the Vatican have consistently refused to release those archives.
Maeve, how much of your anger and disappointment specifically about this lukewarm response from Francis is about Francis, a pope who so many people were counting on to blaze a path to accountability for the past?
You know, I think you've really hit the nail on the head there, Marco. When Pope Francis was elected, I think we all had high hopes that this papacy was going to be different, that he was going to really tackle vigorously the issue of child sexual abuse. He has been in office now for 5 years. Nothing has changed. He did put in place a commission for the protection of minors, in fact, which is chaired by the current Archbishop of Boston. But that commission has proved to be absolutely toothless. One of the prominent Irish survivors was appointed to that commission, Mary Collins, and she is a woman of great integrity who is a practicing mass-going Catholic who resigned last year in sheer frustration at the fact that every single proposal that was made by the commission was somewhat warmly received by Francis, but was utterly stymied by the Curia. And these were very practical, straightforward proposals.
That was Maeve Lewis, the executive director of One in Four, a group that helps survivors of childhood sex abuse in Dublin. Finally today, ever heard of Aleppo soap? It's a traditional kind of soap from Syria, made from natural ingredients, mostly olive oil and laurel oil, and many Syrians believe it can clean almost anything. But after the war in Syria halted production, one French-Syrian entrepreneur decided to carry on his ancestral tradition in France. Adeline Sia has a story.
Samir Constantini should have been born in France, but his Syrian mother insisted on traveling back home to Damascus just to give birth to him. Constantini grew up in France, where he eventually became a physician, but he never lost his affinity for his parents' culture, including a love for an ancient household staple, Aleppo soap. Every summer, Constantini's wife would bring some of the soap back from Syria.
Et j'ai beaucoup aimé ce savon et je lui dis, écoute, tu sais, ce savon-là.
I told her, I loved this soap. I'm sure in France, this will be very successful. That's how I got the idea. The idea was to import Aleppo soap into France. So in 2004, Constantini headed to Syria, where he bought 7 tons of it. It took Constantini 2 years to sell his entire stock. But instead of giving up, he went back to Aleppo and bought 12 more tons of the stuff. Eventually, the product caught on. His family got involved in the business, and he rented the big warehouse.
Maintenant, au contraire, les gens en France préfèrent un savon fabriqué en Syrie.
Now it's the opposite, he says. French people prefer Aleppo soap made in Syria. Constantini says the company's website sales and export to Europe and Asia began to swell. He called his company Aleppia. It's now based in Saint-Denis, just outside Paris, where I met him recently.
I've never been in a warehouse that smells so good. It feels like it's even good for your lungs.
Constantini says it's the laurel bay essential oil that gives that healthy and clean smell. For years, Constantini was able to import his soap directly from Aleppo, where it was handmade in large cauldrons following a recipe said to be 3,000 years old. But in 2012, the war changed everything. Soap factories were destroyed. His main Syrian soap maker had fled war-torn Aleppo for Lebanon. So Constantini asked him to come to France to work for him. And that's what Hassan Haristani did. Down on the factory's main production floor, I meet Haristani.
Bonjour. Nice meeting you.
Haristani is 64 and known as a master soap maker in Syria. He ran his own factory there for 30 years, right until the war began. And he credits Aleppo soap with helping to save his life.
We are living in a secure place, a beautiful country, nice people. And my children are with me. For that reason, I'm living in peace.
Today, Haristani is working on a large batch. It's stirred at a hot temperature for 3 days in a tall, 2-ton capacity stainless steel vat. Then the mixture that looks like thick pea soup is poured out, one big bucket at a time, and spread into square molds with a large spoon.
You know that Aleppo soap in Syria, it's 3-in-1.
Haristani says because the soap is 100% natural, you can clean even fragile items with it, from baby clothes to fine rugs. Making Aleppo soap requires time. It needs to dry and mature, just like great cheese. So the soap will sit for 9 months on wooden racks before being sent to retail stores.
The floor is slippery. Soap on the floor, right?
C'est vrai que il y a pas mal de poudre de savon, étant donné que.
The company's owner, Samir Constantini, explains that there is soap powder on the floor because once the bars are dry, they are scraped to remove the salt that's part of the production process. It's clear that Constantini is proud that his perseverance with the once little known ancient bar of soap has paid off.
Le savon d'Alep a été en quelque sorte un petit peu aussi réfugié en France.
Aleppo soap has been a sort of refugee in France, he says. It allowed us to continue the traditional making here. For now, the violence has quieted down in Aleppo, and some soap factories have reopened there. Constantini says he hopes the resurgence of this ancient soap is a sign that peace may be coming to his ancestral home soon. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Paris, France.
And we leave you clean today. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.